Thank you. The Mideast has been the cradle of civilization, yet it always had warring factions, from biblical times to Egyptian to Roman, Middle Ages, the Ottoman Empire to today. Do things never change? As former Secretary of State Alexander Haig, who was under President Reagan, said about 35 years ago, when you look at the history of the Mideast, it's been one of failure and frustration, of feudalism and tribalism. So, is there any way out of this bubbling cauldron? Is there any hope? Here to enlighten us is Danny Pletka. Danielle is a Senior Vice President, Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, which is a neo-conservative think tank. She writes regularly on national security matters with a special focus on Iran, the Middle East, and South Asia. Before joining AEI, Ms. Pletka was the longtime senior professional staff member of the Senate Committee of Foreign Relations, where she specialized in the Near East and South Asia as the point person for the Middle East, Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan. So you have lots to ask her in the Q&A. Ms. Pletka is the co-editor of Dissent and Reform in the Arab World, the co-author of Containing and Deterring a Nuclear Iran, and also co-author of Iranian Influence in the Levant, Egypt, Iraq, and Afghanistan. She is regularly seen on television. You might have seen her yesterday on Meet the Press. Poor Mimi was worried, why wasn't she on the plane? Or Fareed Zakaria, or Face the Nation. She's been published in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. She has an MA from Johns Hopkins International School, and a BA from Smith College. She was born in Australia in 1953. Oh, 63. Hey. No wonder she can wear those high heels. Where do you see them? And is the mother of four. Please welcome to Naples, Danny Pletka.
Okay, I'm sorry. Do I look like I was born in 1953? Come on, everybody. No! I don't know how I can live up to this introduction. I really don't. First of all, the bubbling cauldron of the Middle East, all of the problems, ancient Egypt, the warring tribes, and then my resume, which was made to sound rather more exalted than it actually is. But thank you. Thank you for making me look young, at least, to my great age, and to look perhaps a little bit smarter than I am. I can't believe you're all here. And I mean that. I don't think I've ever come to a World Affairs Council meeting with so many people. I don't think I've ever come to an AEI meeting with so many people. This is hugely impressive, and it really is a testament to your leadership and to your community. So engaged and interested. I don't know whether I'm going to be interesting or you may hate me, but no matter what, I can't tell you how much I admire this. This is great, so good on all of you. Let me just throw some things out. The Middle East is one of those areas that everybody pays a lot of attention to, so I'm going to say things that I learned at lunch that make some people mad and say some things that make some people happy, especially their wives some of the time. And what I really want to do is to provide some fodder for what passes for conversation with an audience of this size, because your questions are going to be much more interesting for you, but also for me to answer. So I'll try not to use up too much of the time in blabbing, and use up a lot of the time in trying to answer questions a little bit less than in a perfunctory way. So people have asked me over the years why it was that I became interested in the Middle East. And it used to be before the Arab Spring that I said it was because I had a bad memory. And in the Middle East, you never have to learn a new dictator's name. They're just always the same. And now I don't say that anymore because there actually has been some change, but I can always say that being a Middle East expert is a growth industry. I'm never going to be out of business. People are never going to be not interested in what the Middle East has to offer. And I guess that's a mixed blessing, but it is one for me nonetheless, because I actually love the region. Less interested in South Asia, I will confess to you, though. If you want to talk about India and Afghanistan and Pakistan, God forbid Sri Lanka, Bhutan, or Nepal, I can give it a try. But just to sort of take it back a second and not talk about the day-to-day. We can talk about Iran, Iraq, current events, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, whatever you'd like afterwards. But one of the things that I wanted to pay attention to a little bit this afternoon was, as we have a new administration coming in, like it, hate it, optimistic, pessimistic, no matter what you are, I don't think anybody can disagree that we are in need of a strategy for the Middle East. Because one of the things that I didn't like about the Obama administration and even later parts of the Bush administration was that we never seemed to be going toward anything. We always seemed to be trying to solve the problems of the day, or maybe the day after. Now, I'm at a think tank. I have the luxury of not having to solve the problems of the day. Nonetheless, my view is that if you want to be president or secretary of state or national security advisor, you probably ought to have it somewhere that you're going. And part of the challenge here in having a strategy towards the Middle East is, first of all, everything is always on fire. There's always a crisis. There's always a problem that you need to address, and that does crowd out strategic thinking. But if you don't do that strategic thinking, you're never going to do anything but be reacting to the latest crisis. What should I do in Iraq? What should I do in Syria? What about Yemen? What about the Iran nuclear deal? All of these questions can be all-consuming. And how should a strategy be formed? What should be the input that goes into our thinking about a better strategy for the region? I believe that it has to be built on a foundation of understanding that a lot of the things that we hear about the Middle East today aren't actually true. So we have in the little intro to me that I would, you know, is the Sunni-Shi'i divide real? What should we do about Syria? And the answer is that none of these things are actually real. They're used as shorthand ways of explaining away and in some ways mitigating the need for a bigger strategy. Okay? But the Sunni-Shi'i divide, notwithstanding the President Obama's 2016 State of the Union address, in which he said that Sunni and Shi'i have been fighting for 1,000 years, something that is demonstrably untrue. But it is a way of suggesting that these are intractable problems. These are not our problems. These people, they've been fighting forever. I think that Neville Chamberlain said something the same about Czechoslovakia before World War II. This is a small country far away of which we know little. You know, let them fight, really. I mean, we Americans, we have bigger fish to fry. And we may have bigger fish to fry. The problem with the Middle East is that their problems always become our problems. So what is the root of those problems? Is the root of those problems Islamism? Or is it Islam? Or is it the Arab-Israeli conflict? Or is it Sunni-Shia antipathies? Or is it the presence of dictators? Or is it the presence of the Islamic Republic of Iran? We can go through the years, and there's always been a different explication for why the Middle East seems to be a problem. And what I would contend to you is that the Middle East is a problem because of governance. The Middle East is a problem because there are more than 300 million people living in the Near East and North Africa, and they are governed, except for the State of Israel, uniformly by a group of dictators and kleptocrats. And while the dictators' names may change, much to my disappointment, the truth is that the kind of governance there is hasn't changed. If anything, over the years, the region has gotten worse rather than better. So, you know, we started post-colonial era with a variety of kings and other sorts of dictators, and then we moved to the rule of the generals in Arab socialism and Arab nationalism, and then we moved to the era of the regular old dictator like Mubarak or Gaddafi or Bashar al-Assad. We had Ba'athism in Iraq. We had Ba'athism in Syria. We had, you know, we had the monarchies of the Gulf. We had the monarchy of Jordan. But none of these countries, even the ones that are our allies, are well governed. The ones that are better governed, are more stable, are the monarchies. So we know about that, and that's actually something interesting to talk about, and I won't have a good answer for whoever wants to ask it, but why the monarchies of the region seem a little more stable. Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Morocco are the ones that people often mention, but some of the Gulf Emirates, Kuwait, and the UAE as well. But even these are incredibly unstable countries, and it is that instability that foments the rise of the Islamic Republic of Iran, that foments the rise of Al-Qaeda, that foments the rise of Hezbollah, that foments the rise of ISIS. And you can start at the beginning with the terrorist groups that existed, the founding of the PLO in 1964, and you can keep going, and I can list more than you can possibly imagine. There's the PLO, okay? There's Hamas. There's Palestinian Islamic Jihad. There's Al-Qaeda. There's ISIS. There's Ansar Beit al-Maqdis. There's Jabhat al-Nusra. And some of them like to change their names. And so, for example, Al-Qaeda in Iraq became ISIS, which became the Islamic State, which some people like to refer for reasons unknown to me as ISIL. All of these groups keep coming. And, you know, people can say to you, oh, no, you know, ISIS is different from Al-Qaeda, which is different from Hamas, which is different from Hezbollah. But fundamentally, that is not true. These are Islamist, extremist, terrorist groups that have, yes, some members, but rest on a foundation of unhappy, disgruntled populations. Okay. Now, is unhappiness the reason someone becomes a terrorist? No. Don't write me off as quite that stupid, I hope. I'll give you plenty of reason to suspect that later. But seriously, it is not these various groups. At a certain point, we need to recognize that these groups come from somewhere. Why do these societies tolerate them? Why do they tolerate the governments that existed before them? Why are they willing to go from Arab nationalism to Arab socialism to Ba'athism to Islamism, you know, one after the other after the other? Why are they always looking for a savior? And the answer is because the governance that they have is terrible. It doesn't deliver political freedom. It doesn't deliver economic prosperity. It doesn't deliver a better future for anybody. Unemployment is 30%, 40% in a lot of these countries. There are more young people than there are old people. We constantly hear about the youth bulge of young men as if it's sort of a thing, but young men need something to do, okay? And guess what? If you don't work, if you don't have the prospect of work, if you don't have the prospect of education, no, it's not true that it's natural for you to become a terrorist, but if you don't have the outlet of anything else, political activity, if the choices offered to you are on one side the dictator and on the other side nothing, it's not a surprise that people are willing to tolerate the other options that are given to them. And so when people say to me, is there something wrong with Islam? I say, no, there's something wrong with the Islamic world. Okay? It's not peculiar to me, at least, and I'm happy to argue this through with people. It's not peculiar to the religion. It is peculiar in too many ways to the region. And I know people don't like this. People think, oh, you know, these are not our problems. It's Chamberlain back again. I don't want to go in and deal with Syria. Look at Iraq. Look what you did in Iraq. See, it was all great. It was so good under Saddam Hussein. And now look at the Pandora's box you've opened. And the reality is that that Pandora's box was always going to open because no dictatorship can last. No dictatorship. Okay? We can go back to the Roman Empire. We can go further back than that. We can go closer to the Soviet Union. Dictatorships cannot last because fundamentally societies will not tolerate them. And if that is the case, And if, in fact, we understand that a better society, a more open society, more freedom, more prosperity is, in fact, the building block of stability, the real building block of sustained stability, then we need to figure out what our strategy is going to be to deliver that. Now, people who don't like this idea will say to you, she just wants to overthrow the government, get rid of the guy, and then put in some election, and then you'll see what happened. They'll elect Hamas, or they'll elect Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood, and that will be just terrible. And the answer is that's right, because a society does not become democratic. For me, a supporter of the Iraq War, for me, the lesson learned about Iraq is that what I thought people had inside them, I thought everybody in the Middle East, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, in Antarctica, I thought everybody was born with what I could caricature as an inner Thomas Jefferson, a person yearning to be free, who understood. And the answer is, you know what, that's not true. People actually don't know what to do if you give them freedom, if they have never had it before. They don't know how to vote, they don't know how to think, and much as if you go into a country that has been under communist diktat for decades and decades, and you say, hey, it's a market economy, go! You end up with a lot of disarray, and you can end up with a lot of bad things. These have to be evolutions. They can't happen tomorrow. They don't happen in the reign of one leader. They don't happen under the leadership of one president or two presidents or even three or four or five presidents. But if we don't know where we're going, and if we are unwilling to use our leverage, then we must recognize that the Middle East will constantly drag us back. Okay? It will constantly bring us into conflict. I defy you to name for me a decade in which we have not, in one form or another, had to engage in the Middle East in a way that we did not wish to engage in the Middle East, in the way that the president who was elected promising to just nation build here at home was dragged back to the Middle East. Because that's what happens when you don't deal with the underlying problem. Now, is it our job to deal with every bad thing that happens to every bad person in the world? Well, A, I would argue, kind of a little bit, yes. But we should do it from selfish motivations. I mean, there are altruistic motivations that I think we as Americans should embrace. But forget it. Let's be selfish people. I won't use any names. But let's be selfish people. And let's say that actually we just don't want to go back there. Let them kill each other. 500,000 Syrians here, there, whatever. You know, sure, it's a terrible shame, and we feel kind of sad when we see that poor little boy on the beach dead. But at the end of the day, we have needs here in the United States, right? We've heard people say this recently. And I understand that, and I understand what comes behind it, and we can't fix everything. But we have to have an idea about what the long-term solution is. And as we work to manage and contain the conflicts that we see throughout the region, we've got to have an idea about what we're pushing for. Okay? Because it can't be nothing. Because we'll just have to keep going back. And I'll keep coming here and I'll give the same speech again and again. Eventually, I actually will be 63. And then we can have this. God, I hope I'm retired. And have exactly the same conversation. And so that's what we need. We need a strategy. And our strategy has to be to push for better governance. Not just better government, not just democratic government, just include, you know, have an election and we're good, but also better economic governance. You know, I try to talk a little bit about these issues because it's not just what people, that is not just what people need. It's not just to go and vote and be able to express yourself in that way. It's also prosperity that people want and need. And what we find throughout the Middle East is that we see a region that has become, over, I would say, the last 10 to 20 years, extraordinarily anti-market, anti-capitalist. Okay. Now, you know, we may have differences of opinion in this room about the wisdom of market economics and capitalism, and we may have a range of views, like Katharine Hepburn's acting ability from A to B, but we don't have a range of ability from A to range of thinking from A to Z. We do not think, well, yes, actually, you know, socialism and communism are really kind of good systems that we ought to try out again. And yet, in the region, what you see is a huge, somewhat Islamist-fueled, but more opportunistically-fueled, anti-market backlash. And I'll tell you exactly why. Because throughout the region, including in places that we like to think of as relatively stable, all of the instruments of the market are in the hands of the leadership. Everything. So pick Mubarak's Egypt. every single thing. I mean, we knew who his bagman was. He was the guy who handed out the monopoly for the beer distributorship, the monopoly for privatizing certain industry, the monopoly for the cement industry and the flour and the grain and every single thing, the Mercedes dealership. And Egypt was no different from anywhere else. The same was true in Syria, the same is true in Jordan, the same is true in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. You can sit down and you can pick out those pillars, economic pillars, and you will see that the people who run them and own them are part of the of what is rightly called crony capitalism. Looks a lot like the new China in that way. So there's a thin layer of these people at the top, and nobody else is benefiting from it. Sure, yes, it's great to get a Coca-Cola because you can now get a Coca-Cola, but that is not a sufficient benefit for people to say to themselves, I'm getting the fruits of this open economic opening. So as a result, when an American government comes to Egypt, for example, and we have our Chamber of Commerce and we have our Secretary of Commerce and our Secretary of State, and we say, you need to make these economic changes, and the IMF goes to them and says, you want to borrow a bunch of money? You need to make some structural changes. The Islamists and the opposition turn around and they say, you look at those people. They are the kleptocrats. They are the ones who have been stealing the resources from you. They are the ones who have stopped you from having a better future. Nobody says to the opposition, okay, what's your plan? Because they believe it. They know it to be true. They see it and they hear it. Okay? And again, we need to be mindful of this. We need to hear this. We need to understand it. And we need to talk about these things as a government. Does that mean that I need to personally manage what the privatization of the Coca-Cola factory in Aswan looks like tomorrow? No, thank you. But it does mean that as we pursue these policies that are aimed at leveraging open governments, leveraging freedom, leveraging people out of prison, leveraging some more political options, leveraging a little bit more economic openness, that as we do those things, we are mindful about how it is exploited. I'm going to stop in just a second, but I want to come back for one second to the Sunni-Shi'i divide, because I think it's become, you know, it, for me, there's that story. I don't know if it's true or apocryphal about John D. Rockefeller and that he decided before the great crash in 1929, was having a shoe shine, and a shoe shine boy was asking him where to invest in the market, and he thought, the moment that my shoe shine guy is in the market, perhaps there's a bubble and I ought to get out, and he got out, and boy, was he happy. So I feel like that about the Middle East when people turn to me and who don't know anything about the region, and they say, well, isn't this just the Sunni and the Shiites, because aren't they really, they've hated each other forever. Like, you have no idea. You don't have any clue about who the Sunni and the Shi'i are. But let me tell you, there's nothing Sunni and Shi'i about the conflict, okay? This is a construct that was invented ex post facto to explain away the problems that we're facing in the region, okay? Because the Shi'i, they don't mean the Shi'i, the Houthis, and they don't mean even the Shi'i in southern Lebanon, and they don't even mean the Shi'i who live in Gaza. They mean Iran, okay? This is Iran. Iran is bad and evil, and they are against the Sunnis. And then, of course, the Iranians come back, and they say, well, right, of course, and we know who the Sunnis are. The Sunnis are the Wahhabis, right? And the Muslim Brotherhood, it's Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And so they're trying to explain this away as a problem of Saudi Arabia and Iran and Turkey, but it's not a problem of them. It is a problem that has existed long before. Hezbollah rose up in southern Lebanon long before we were talking about the Sunni-Shi'i divide in the Middle East. Okay, they were founded in 1992 by the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And it was long before anybody was talking about sectarian conflict between different parts of the Muslim faith. So I don't believe that that is a source of the problem. Is Iran a source of the problem? Absolutely. Does Iran destabilize the region? For sure. Is Saudi Arabia a problem and is Wahhabism a problem? Absolutely. But is it at the root of the conflict in the Middle East right now? Is this the reason why a Tunisian man went and immolated himself and began the stream that began the Arab Spring? Is that it? Because I can tell you, that's not it. Okay. It has nothing to do with it. It is a product rather than the source of the problem. And so as we think about the future, you know, again, I'm at a think tank. I don't have to do, you don't have to do with the day-to-day. I don't have to meet with ambassadors every day. I don't have to deal with Americans being kidnapped, and I don't have to deal with, you know, arms shipments of going to the Houthi rebels in Yemen and figuring out how to deal with that. I don't have to do that every day. I can afford to think big, and that's why think tanks are good things. Because the government can't think this way, and we do our best to influence the government to embrace bigger policies, better thinking, more strategery, as George W. Bush would have said. Those are good things. So I think I have no idea how long I've talked. I don't have my timer on. It's 4:12. We started at 3:45. We have tons of time for questions. I've thrown lots of red meat out there for you. If you don't ask me questions, I will make them up. I'm really good at that. I can keep babbling on forever. But why don't you? How do we do this? I didn't actually ask that in advance.
I need the microphone.
The mic? Oh, thank you. Thank you. If you would line up at the microphone to ask a question. And their microphones are there and there.
I have a question that's kind of asking about root cause. And you mentioned governance in a general sense. Some observations. One is the fact that in this Islamic area, although in others where it's not a problem, there's no separation between church and state. And another observation, you look at innovation, ingenuity, Nobel Prizes. You see none of that come out of the Middle East. Is that a cause or an effect?
Those are all decent observations and true. There is no separation of church and state in Islam. Is that the root of the problem? Well, let's say that it's an excuse for the problem. Certainly the Iranian leadership likes to suggest that, in fact, they are there with the authority of God and that they are the spokesman for God on earth and that, therefore, they should be the ones who are governing and the Quran tells you how to govern. And that's all very neat and convenient for them. But I would argue strongly that actually the problem is a culture of criticism rather than a failure of the Quran, which, you know, I mean, we can go back and forth. I'm not an Islamic scholar. You can find plenty of things in the Quran to suggest that there should be a more separation of church and state. It becomes this sort of he said, she said argument in which none of us ends up leaving very satisfied. The reason for both is that critical thinking isn't taught. You know, when you don't teach critical thinking in schools, you have people who accept dictatorship. When you don't teach critical thinking in schools, you can tell them that it's supposed to be this way, and that's how it ends up being. And I think that people fail to appreciate what 7 or 8 decades of rotten education means. We're starting to learn a little bit about that here, unfortunately. But it's meaningful, okay? If you tell, you know, I always try and tell my Iran scholars this. There are a lot of people. So, step back for a second. The Iranian Revolution happened. The Islamic Revolution in Iran happened in 1979. I'm trying to look at the person who asked the question, but I'm just going to look at all of you. Sorry. Happened in 1979, right? So we had a huge cohort of people who ran away from Iran who were all associated with the Shah, or they were secularists, or they had cleverly stored all their money overseas, or for whatever reason, they ran away. And they became the core of both Iranian scholarship and the Iranian opposition to the Islamic Republic of Iran in the United States. Okay, they have now aged. The Shah is dead. His son is not that young either. And they are sort of frozen in time. Can we go back just to the good times of the 1970s? And the answer is, it has been a long time. Okay? If you were born in 1979, mind you, just born in 1979, you have big children now. Okay? You went through school and they went through school. If you went through schools in the Islamic Republic, I don't care whether you were listening to Voice of America or you were listening to Radio Farda or you were listening to any of the great efforts that we make to try to speak to the Iranian people, you think that the Israelis caused the 1967 war. You think that Egypt won the 1973 war. You think that Jews are the source of all ill in the world because you have been learning this for years on end. And even if you are a really smart guy and you've been trying to reach out, the reality is that if your base education, it kind of goes back to what I said about Iraq, you don't know what truth is because there is no truth. It's what you've learned. So even, let's say in a magical world that we overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran and we bring in, these guys aren't going to be much better. Because what they have learned about the world is false. And that is the challenge. It is a lack of education. It is a lack of critical thinking. Why don't you have Nobel Prize winners? Why don't you have patents coming out of the region? Why don't you have things being invented? Why don't you have beautiful film and beautiful art? Well, you have a little bit of it, but you don't have it in any comparable way to Europe, to Israel, to the United States. Why? Okay. Because fundamentally, everything about the leadership, everything about governance, everything about the social system stifles that. I don't think that it is that if you bring a bunch of Muslim Arab kids into school and you educate them from birth, in the Brookline public school system that educated me, that somehow they're going to be just that much dumber, that they're not going to have that imagination. I don't believe it. I don't think it's true. But if one of you knows it to be true, I'll certainly hear it. I think that is the challenge. You can't expect that a region like that is going to be like that. And similarly, I would say that if you look at other captive nations, if you look at what happened during the Cold War behind the Iron Curtain, while you may have seen some things, you may have seen some bright shining lights, you may have seen Václav Havel, you may have seen others, you didn't see a lot of the things that we're talking about because they were all stifled in a culture which did have that rooting in Western civilization. These folks don't even have that. And after living under these Arab dictatorships for so many years, I'm surprised they do what they do, let alone more. Yes, sir.
Thank you for your enlightening perspective. I wonder if you'd comment on how you see the impact of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on the broader issues that you've been talking about with regard to the Middle East.
I didn't bring it up in the beginning, in large part because first of all, somebody always reliably asks about it, but second of all, because one of the things that has driven me crazy as a Middle East scholar over these many, many decades is being asked about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Isn't it at the root of everything that's wrong in the region? Isn't it really why everybody is unhappy? Isn't it really why they have to have a dictatorship in Syria or Iraq? Because if they had a democracy, they wouldn't be able to focus all their attention on freeing the Palestinians, who notably have not been freed by all of these awesome governments, these many years. So, I guess my simple view is that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is nothing more than an excuse in most of the Arab world. One, by the way, that people in the Gulf have totally stopped talking about. It's incredible. You go to Saudi Arabia, you could go for 3 hours in debate about what to do about the region before they even mention Israel or the Palestinians. That was never the case before. Similarly, a lot of other parts. I would say still in Syria and Lebanon, you still hear it, but not as much. Do the Israelis and the Palestinians need to make peace? Yes, the Israelis and the Palestinians need to make peace. It's bad for Israel. It's bad for the Palestinians. What do the Palestinians need? They need governance. They need institutions. If you look at the Palestinians now and you look at them 40 years ago, there is not a single indicator in which they're better off. Okay? We cannot blame the Israelis for all of this. They have lousy government. Yasser Arafat, Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, the president who's in the fourth iteration of his first term as president and hasn't had an election. These people should be ashamed. And the fact that they're not, Israel is their excuse. The Palestinians have become more Islamist. They have become less educated. They have become less prosperous. They have become less diverse. This is not all the fault of the Jews, as much as they would have us believe it. It is the fault of lousy Palestinian leadership and the fact that the world has always been willing to give them a pass because they are oppressed. And I'm really much less game about that than the United Nations and others. I think that it should be a priority for the United States to help the Palestinians get to a place where they can actually reasonably make peace with the Israelis. I think it would be terrific if it were at a place where we didn't have to worry about whether they were going to embrace terrorism or become a beachhead for Al-Qaeda or for Hezbollah. But they have not done a very good job of reassuring us, even though the Obama administration was not sufficiently reassured by the Palestinians to actually push forward or force upon the Israelis a peace agreement, notwithstanding the valedictory efforts of Samantha Power at the United Nations and John Kerry. So is it important? Yes. Does it relate to the problems of the Middle East? No. The Palestinians are a mirror of other people's problems in the Arab world. That's what I would say. Yes, sir.
Well, you went to Smith, so this should be, and you look around, you'll find that at least half of an audience are women. And I've got a couple of Harvard daughters and a very feminist wife. Until we get rid of the cultural deprivation of women in the Middle East and in their culture, that's a fundamental problem. And we can educate kids and little girls in Afghanistan, but when we leave, they won't be going back to school. 50% are disenfranchised. 50% that have very strong reasons for a better government are disenfranchised. It was amazing to me living in Iran that these women put on a chador after going to the university and went back to the kitchen.
I didn't fully understand, but I think you're asking about the disenfranchisement of women. Speaking as a woman, you're not fully right about that. There are places where women are totally disenfranchised. Saudi Arabia is one of them. But in fact, even in Iran, where women are forced to wear the chador or the hijab, and in which women are oppressed and have fewer rights than men legally in terms of divorce, and have fewer opportunities than men in terms of work, I would say that women are not quite as oppressed as you laid out in your question. Are women oppressed? Yes. Do I support the notion of Sharia law? No. Do you lose a lot when your part of your population doesn't have the same rights as the other part? Yes. Is that a bad thing? Yes. Are they starting to recognize that? Interestingly enough, I'm going to Saudi Arabia at the end of next week, and I was meeting with this guy from the embassy just to plan the trip on Friday. And, you know, they're really trying to figure out how to do something about this. Now, I don't know whether they're trying to do that to shut us up or because they actually genuinely believe that there is a place for women in their society. But one way or another, we are leveraging that door open. And I think we can do it well. The one thing that I don't like is the notion that we will get bought off by increased women's rights. You know, I think that the Saudis, if I were a shrewd Saudi leader who had wanted for many years to have a better relationship with the United States but not change my system, I would have said, sure, women can drive. Nothing else, but women can drive. Because that's like our thing, right? Women can't drive. It's terrible. That's the one thing everybody knows. Women can't drive in Saudi Arabia. Women can drive everywhere else in the Middle East, but they can't drive in Saudi Arabia. And they can drive in a lot of parts of Saudi Arabia, but not in the capitals. They didn't do that. They're not quite that shrewd, or they didn't want to. It's a big thing, but it's not the biggest thing. And it shouldn't distract us from the larger problems. The one thing that I always disagree with is the notion that women somehow will be softer and more liberal. Just speaking as the meanest person in my family, let me tell you. And I have three girls, and they're also quite unpleasant. Women are not the weaker sex, and they will not bring a softer, gentler, new Middle East. This is one of the things that we see, and it has struck me as I've looked at some of ISIS's activities, how many women have been brought in. Yes, it's a lot of young men, but there are a lot of women who are there, you know, supporting them in lock, stock, and barrel for the ISIS leadership. So, you know, we need better everything, and yes, more women too. I hope I answered your question a little bit. I'm not 100% sure. Yes, sir.
In the context of resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, how can one harmonize the division within the Palestinian camp with Israeli skepticism?
What do you mean exactly?
We have an issue, correct?
Well, yeah, I don't think anybody's going to argue about that.
We have a division within the Palestinian camp.
Yeah.
We have Israeli skepticism. How do you harmonize that?
Israeli skepticism about what?
About the intention of the other side.
Well, justly placed skepticism, if I may say so. Although, again, you know, these are, look, you know, everybody likes these caricatures of the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You know, there is skepticism on the Israeli side about the intentions of the Palestinians, which, you know, they know each other best. And I think the Israelis are right to be skeptical because over the last 20 to 30 years, they have seen the Palestinians governed by a successively worse group of leaders, with some small moments of exception in that. They've seen Abu Mazen, who's in the fourth iteration of his first term as president of the Palestinian Authority, and they've seen these unity governments between Hamas, a terrorist group, and Fatah, and I think that they are right to have their doubts. For the Palestinians' part, you know, look, I always say the same thing about the Palestinians, and it's not very pleasing to partisans of either side. But the bottom line is that there is never going to be a peace agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians until the Palestinians figure out how to govern themselves decently. Okay. And if you look at what has happened to the Palestinians over the last 30 years, what you see is that everything about their lives is worse. Everything. Their prosperity is worse. Their economic indicators are worse. Their education is worse. The Palestinian management class that used to be the hallmark of the Middle East is gone. The Christian communities that used to enrich the Palestinian life in Bethlehem and in Nazareth and elsewhere are gone. The families that were the pillars of Palestinian life, many of them have fallen apart. They're gone. And you see more and more women who are veiled, you see more and more extremism, you see more and more conflict, you see crime, you see corruption. It's really bad, and you can't blame the Jews for all of it. Some of it if you want, but not all of it. And the truth is that we have had administrations that focused on institution building and on governance among the Palestinians. If the Palestinians had a system of government that worked, that delivered to them, they would be far less interested in whether their border was 20 feet here or 20 feet there. And there'll always be purists who suggest that it has to be here and they can never accept the state of Israel. But at the end of the day, the heart of the problem is that the center of Palestinian governance and of negotiating is not a partner to do business with. And the Palestinians have helped those in the Israeli camp who don't want to do it. Because the Israelis say with some ease and some justification, we don't have a partner for peace. And we look at Abu Mazen and we look at Gaza and we say, a little bit. That's kind of a problem. So, you know, that doesn't mean that I have the great solution, but it does mean that as we focus on this, focusing on leaning on the Israelis to accept things is not really the way forward. Focusing on the Palestinians and how to actually better their lot and their situation, to my mind, is a much better priority. So, thank you. Yes, sir.
You've used the word leverage at times, and I'm curious, what does the United States have for leverage in the Middle East? And I think I'd take that maybe a step further. You've identified several problems. So where do we start, or who starts, with moving, you know, to have a strategy? And what would be some items in such a strategy?
I mean, it's a very fair question. You know, we've had 8 years of being told that we have no leverage. I would say that the notion that the largest economy and the largest military in the entire world by far has quite a lot of leverage pretty much everywhere. Now, does that mean that every problem is a nail and every solution is a hammer? No, it doesn't. It shouldn't mean that. You know, there are not military solutions to a lot of the problems that we face. Sometimes it just requires persistence. Sometimes the leverage that we have is actually as simple as the good housekeeping seal of approval of the United States. You know, I'll tell you a little story that tells you how little it takes, that doesn't involve criticizing the Obama administration, which I have a habit of doing. And this is during the Bush administration. During the Bush administration, Hosni Mubarak didn't want to, was being told he shouldn't run again. He had cancer. He's not doing that well, although he's still not dead. But he really, what he wanted to do was he wanted to anoint his son, Gamal Mubarak. Gamal Mubarak is not a bad guy. He's an economist. He's a smart guy. He's well known in the United States. He speaks very good English. He's very well educated. A lot of people thought he would be a good liberalizer. He's not a Bashar Assad or a Kim Jong-un. But everybody recognized that anointing Gamal Mubarak was basically another dynasty in the Middle East, and the Egyptian people didn't want another dynasty in the Middle East. And there was sort of a recognition of that at a pretty senior working level inside the Bush administration. Don't do this. We shouldn't do this. We need to tell Mubarak, no, you need to step down and have elections. Yes, you can rig the elections and have your, but don't anoint your son. Okay, that's not a good thing. And even there, I would say, as a matter of grand strategy, you're moving, you know, in the right direction, okay? Opening it up to elections. What happened? So Gamal Mubarak is coming. He's regularly coming and kind of looking for that pat on the back that he's going to get. And he's having a meeting, and no, you know, State Department, everybody says, no, no, you can't meet with the president, can't see the president, don't want this to be misinterpreted. No, you can't see the president, okay? So he goes and he's having a meeting at the National Security Council, and guess who dropped by? Yes. The president. And let me tell you, the Egyptians took that 100% as the license to anoint Gamal Mubarak. And it was when Mubarak made it clear that that was fully what he intended to do, that the momentum to overthrow him grew, and that the military decided to back those people who wanted to overthrow him, because it was the wrong choice, and it was George Bush who sent that signal. Leverage is walking into a meeting or not walking into a meeting. You know, people say we can't do things. Look at Burma. It's a country where the stakes are reasonably low for the United States. So as a result, people don't pay attention. You know, so what? They don't like our sanctions? Tough luck. But the Burmese have been working assiduously for the last 20 years, dictatorship in place, to try and get out from under U.S. sanctions. Okay? They're not close to us. They don't sell oil. There's no, right? There's nothing there. They'd just been trying to get out from under their sanctions. And they couldn't, and they didn't. They didn't want to let Aung San Suu Kyi run. They didn't want to open up the government. They didn't want to open up the economy. But what decided the military junta that was running Burma finally that they needed to do something to change it was that they did not like the fact that they were being bossed around by the People's Republic of China. That more and more and more, and they couldn't take it. They thought it was presenting too much of a risk for them. And so they came to us and said, okay, what do we need to do? Okay, we see there are sanctions in place. What do we need to do to get you to lift those sanctions? Because we want our future to be on your side. Hey, okay, yes, so we're doing better in Burma. You know, big whoop, it's not Syria, I get it. But we have so much leverage. And our leverage goes from things that you would count as completely irrelevant to things that are, you know, the 101st Airborne. We have economic leverage. We have political leverage. One thing that we don't have is discipline across government, okay? And that makes it very hard. That requires leadership. You know, Ronald Reagan had good qualities and he had bad qualities, although I was very fond of him. But one thing that he did well was that he ran his government. James Baker helped him. But he ran his government. You did not have four different Latin America policies. You did not have three different policies towards the Soviet Union. You had one. And it drove in a particular direction with a desired outcome. And yes, we weren't going to get there once, and we weren't going to get there the next time, and we weren't going to get there the third time. And sometimes we gave in, and sometimes we didn't. But at the end of the day, we have enormous leverage. You know, people say, oh, you know, you can't boss the world around anymore. It's not a bipolar world, it's a multipolar world. I have not noticed the reams of Syrians racing to get into China, weirdly, or into Russia, strangely, nor have I noticed that anybody who is in trouble has turned to Moscow and said, help me, please. They come to us. Okay, that's leverage. All of this is leverage. And the things that we've been doing over the last 10 years have diminished our leverage, for sure. But it's still there. And I think that the goodwill of the American people is huge leverage. And I think that our generosity throughout this century and the last, represents huge leverage. We need to be focused on where we're going, and we need strong, not dictatorial, but strong leadership to get there. Anybody who tells you we don't have any leverage is lying. It's because they don't want to use it. Barack Obama didn't want to use it. Okay? Period. I know, all of the Democrats are going to come leaping on me afterwards and telling me how awful and wrong I am. But you know what? I'll tell you something interesting. Total aside, this has nothing to do with Democrat-Republican politics. In Washington, there is a huge unity among liberal internationalists. My closest crony and working partner on the Middle East, the guy who I'm going to Saudi Arabia with, is at the Center for American Progress, which couldn't be more to the left, which did everything for Hillary to be elected. Okay? We work huge, closely together all the time. Brookings, Carnegie, the Center for American Progress, even the Heritage Foundation, all of us, because we believe in America and the world. We believe that we're a force for good. We believe that we can use the leverage we have. We care about what's happening in Syria and in Iraq and in Yemen and in Russia and in China. We care about those things, and we want America to continue to be engaged, not at war, okay, not dictating, but engaged in that part of the world, and there is no difference between us. That is one of the gifts of the last few years, is that the frustration of liberal internationalists, whether they were on the left or the right, with the administration's unwillingness to do anything about certain things, brought us together. And I think it's a marriage made in heaven, and I hope it'll continue. Please, another question.
What should our policy be in Syria?
Somebody finally asked a really hard question. That is the great question, and it's a $64,000 question. And every year that we've had that we've faced a challenge in Syria since 2011, I've known what to do and say. In fact, I would say I have a strong feeling about what to do. Maybe not workable, maybe not, you know, maybe not magical, maybe not even doable. In most parts of the Middle East, I don't really know what to do about Syria. I think that the solution is not to decide that Assad is the solution, because Assad doesn't exist anymore. You know, he may be there, but he is not a force to be reckoned with. And he controls only a small area of the country. The solution is not to decide that an Iranian-led compact in Syria was a good idea, which is what the Obama administration believed. And I think because they believed it was the solution. You know, Syria and Russia and Iran could get together and they could just manage it. But that's not a solution, because it still represents a huge threat to us. ISIS will grow. ISIS has continued to grow in both Iraq and Syria, even as they've been squashed into smaller and smaller territories. I think the first job is, there are two first jobs. They have to come in parallel. The first is to decide how we want Syria or the parts of Syria to be governed. And that means that you got to pick the people who are going to win. Americans always like to say, we don't want to pick winners. And in foreign policy, we all love to pick winners in football, although many of you were wrong. I'm from Boston. But in foreign policy, people like to say, we don't like to pick winners. And the answer is, we should like to pick winners. We should pick people who are going to govern in a way that is congenial to our national interest and to our values. And are they going to be perfect? No. And if they're not like that, we need to make them like that. And what many fail to understand is our history is replete with examples of us picking somebody and saying, you're going to be the government. Oh, yeah, you better do this, 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 and this. You can't do this, 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 and this. You know, it is completely normal. And for us to use our weight to say to the groups that make up the Free Syrian Army, you have to be the Free Syrian Army. You've got to stick together. You've got to stop arguing with each other. You've got to stop trying to take more territory. You've got to stop trying to kill each other. That's perfectly legitimate policy. We want you to govern this area. And then we've got to decide what We've got to decide with our allies, with the Saudis, with the Turks, and even if necessary, with the Russians, we've got to decide what we want the status quo to be. And then we've got to go in there and we've got to kill ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And don't think it's just ISIS in Syria, okay? Al-Qaeda is there in force. They've changed their name, they've changed their tactics, but it is Al-Qaeda. And one of the things that no one's asked me about, and I can't believe that, 16 years, 15 and a half years after 9/11, no one's asked me about Al-Qaeda. So I'm going to answer that question of myself in just a second. But I think that those are the two parallel things. What do we need to do to get rid of ISIS? We need to step up our air campaign. We need to end resupply that they get. We need to end the resupply that the Iranians are getting, that the Iranians and the Russians are giving to Assad. We need to take out their airstrips. We need to choke off all rat lines and means of ingress and egress, and then we need to kill them where they are. We need to do a good job at it. Yeah, when I say that, I kill them. And we need to be engaged. It needs to work. The president needs to be behind whoever's doing this. Now, do I think that's going to happen in a Trump administration? No, I don't think that. But I will say there's absolutely no magic plan. You know, I was boasting about one of my scholars, Fred Kagan, who runs our Critical Threats Project, and Fred is the one who wrote the plan for the surge in Iraq. It's awesome for a think tank to help to win a war. We're not going to be the ones who help to find the magic bullet that wins the Syria war, because we, like our colleagues, like Steve Cook, who you'll hear from, like John Allen, who you heard from, and Michael O'Hanlon, they will tell you, this is a big, big challenge. So we can make it better. We can move to calm the situation. We can settle it down. We can try and mitigate and contain the threat to us and to our allies. But is there some magic answer? Some cheat? No, there is none. 5 years ago there was one, 4 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago. There isn't one now, and I don't have a magic answer. I wish I did. I love Syria. I've been there many, many times. It's a great place, and it kills me to see 500,000 people dead, and the United States standing by saying that's a shame. I want to just take my 1 second before you go and talk about Al-Qaeda, because I've done a lot of talking about what I think. But we do a lot of work on this, and it's the one thing, it's the big threat you're not paying attention to. It really is. You know, Al-Qaeda was a threat that was contained in Pakistan, Afghanistan, to a certain extent, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Al-Qaeda is now in North Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa. It's in Libya, it's in Egypt, it's in Lebanon, it's in Syria, it's in Iraq, it's in Algeria, it's in Tunisia, it's in Yemen, it's in Somalia, it's in Nigeria, it's in Mali, and it's in a few other countries that I can't remember right now. It is everywhere. They have changed their strategy. They are not attacking us for a reason. They have decided that this is not what they want to do right now. They want us to focus all our attention on ISIS, but they are working. They are larger than they ever were. They have more territory in which they're operating now. They are very, very well positioned for the future. And we have paid very little attention to them. We picked out a guy here and a guy there, and a guy here and a guy there. They're in Afghanistan and Pakistan and India as well. And I've got to say, you know, I asked one of my guys this week, what would you say is the next big threat we're not thinking about? And he said, Al-Qaeda in Africa. We have no resources. We got a few hundred guys in the Lake District in Africa, and Trump wants to take them out. And we're going to have nobody there at all. And this is something that no one is focused on. I used to get teased because we paid a lot of attention to Yemen within our foreign and defense policy team at AEI. And finally, my boss came to me and he said, yeah, I'm really sorry. I knew I was teasing you a lot about the fact that you were focusing on Yemen and no one cared. He said, we really should care. Now I understand. Let me tell you, all of these other places I just listed off on my hand, they are a huge challenge, a huge threat to us. And unless we begin to step it up, unless we begin to reinvest in our military, unless we have a strategy that actually deals with it, that tries to preempt it, we will end up with problems that are little Syrias all over the place. And we may not care about Mali. God knows I don't care about Mali. We may not care about any of these places, but they will care about us, and they will come and get us. So with that very stark and not very humorous warning, thank you so much for being a great audience.
Thank you.